I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. The supply chain crisis has plenty of holiday shoppers starting early this year. Even though it's not yet Halloween, it's already Christmas stocking stuffer time. Now, if kids are on your holiday list, you might notice that things are looking a little less pink and blue these days. In recent years, some parents and advocates have pushed to break the binary when it comes to our kids' toys. Last week, Lego, the world's largest toy maker, announced it would make its toys more gender neutral. And earlier this month, the state of California passed a law requiring large retailers to display toys and childcare items in gender neutral ways. I spoke with Elizabeth Sweet, assistant professor of sociology at San Jose State University, and I started by asking whether she's surprised by Lego's recent decision.
It is a little surprising in that even just 5 years ago, the toy industry was really resistant to making these kinds of changes. They were really interested more in broadening the categories for boys and for girls rather than deconstructing them. So it is a little surprising to see them make this commitment. But on the other hand, I think it's not surprising in that if we look at where society is and the conversations we're having about gender, you know, I think the toy industry is really playing catch up and recognizing that it's not really profitable anymore to rely so heavily on gender stereotyping. So it's a kind of a yes and no.
Let's talk about gender stereotyping in toys, because this goes to the heart of your research. And I think it's one of those things that we think of as always true, right? Just always true that there were girls' toys and boys' toys. But you actually show that there's change over time.
Yeah, absolutely. So in my research, I examined toy catalogs from the 20th century to try to understand how toys have been marketed historically, particularly in regards to gender, but also in regards to race. And so what I found in this research is that historically, toys were a lot less gendered than they were in the 21st century. And also that there was a lot of variation over time in the extent of gender marketing and in the ways in which gender coding was accomplished. But as we see today, those historic shifts in gender marketing were really connected to larger shifts that were happening in society in terms of cultural beliefs about gender and in the structures of gender inequality in the adult world. So I think, you know, now we're in a moment where there's a lot of contestation around gender. So it doesn't surprise me that we're seeing this play out in the world of children's toys, but people tend to think this is something that's always been this way. And that's just really not the case. Historically, toys were much less likely to be gendered than they are today.
As a parent, my eldest is nearly 20 now. And I got to say, over those two decades, you know, like one of the phrases I've picked up is, you know, before you're a parent, you're a sociologist and you think that it's all about how children are reared. And after you have children, you're a geneticist and you're like, nope, they just showed up like this. This one may be much less in my control than I think. So help me to understand what's at stake here. I mean, I just will say, my nephew is going to pick up anything and turn it into a sword, even if you never give him a sword to play with.
It's really hard to tease out the effects of any one thing on kids when kids are born into a world where everything is gender coded. You know, gender categorization is one of the most primary categorizations that we make as humans. And, you know, all of these categorizations carry this heavy set of cultural beliefs and stereotypes around them. So, you know, by the time kids are 3 or 4, they have been exposed. They've, you know, been swimming in this sea of gender stereotypes. So when we look at a child and see them kind of responding to these stereotypes, perhaps it's not surprising. But there's a lot of really excellent work in the field of developmental psychology that finds that kids' preferences and interests really are shaped by these products. And if you label something for boys or for girls, it affects how kids feel about it and whether they think it's appropriate for them. Is it surprising that girls tend to prefer pink when everything, all of their products are pink? If you give people one choice, they're going to choose that, right? So, but I think what we find is that if you give kids a much broader selection of choice, and if there aren't heavy social costs and potential social benefits for choosing particular choices, then kids are much more likely to, you're much more likely to see the diversity of interests that kids have.
I've also noticed there is, and maybe this is, as you just pointed out, the issue of social costs, that gender fluidity and gender neutrality across toys and play interests seems to be sufficiently well, or maybe not sufficiently, but it is rewarded or at least not punished for girls who make gender neutral or what we would think of as gender fluid choices into preferences we tend to think of as male. So, you know, my 7-year-old really liking Blaze and the Monster Machines, everybody's down for that. No problem. Blaze and the Monster Machines for the 7-year-old girl. But the gender fluidity from male to female, the idea of my nephew wanting to carry around a baby doll, oh, that gets policed and people will take the doll out of his hand.
The line between sort of girls' toys and everything else has always been much sharper than the line between boys' toys and gender neutral. In fact, historically, like, boys' toys and gender neutral were really hard to distinguish sometimes, you know, in terms of color schemes and things like that. But I do think that boys are sanctioned much more heavily for transgressing those gender norms. And that's a really big thing to worry about, because, you know, the toys that promote social skills, that promote empathy and caring, those are marketed almost exclusively to girls. And yet, you know, boys go on to parent. They, you know, compassion and care are just human characteristics that are beneficial to our society. So relegating those characteristics only to girls is problematic. And, you know, in the same way, I think toy lines that have tried to expand femininity, you know, making STEM toys pink for girls, that's problematic too, because again, it suggests that girls are fundamentally different mm-hmm. and incapable of just doing science. Science is not gendered. So why do we have to gender it to appeal to girls?
What moves corporations to make these kinds of decisions? Is it legislative action, like the recent bill in California? Or is it marketing pressure from parents and caregivers who are purchasing the toys?
That's a great question. I mean, I think some of the changes, like we're seeing from Lego, or Mattel has made some similar changes within the past couple of years, those are really about money, right? They understand that the parents of today have a lot more progressive attitudes about gender than parents of, you know, 10 years ago, perhaps. So they recognize that this is going to be profitable for them. But it shouldn't be left to the goodness of a company's heart, you know, or whether it's profitable for them to make sure that our products are good for our kids. So in that way, I think the legislation is incredibly important. And the legislation in California is really aimed at, you know, at the retail side. So making sure that that there is an option for a gender neutral toy aisle, even if the rest of the toy aisles are kind of pink and blue. But the toys themselves are still very heavily gendered. So we need to address both the way that toys are sold, but also the way that toys are made and marketed.
Elizabeth Sweet is an assistant professor of sociology at San Jose State University. Professor Sweet, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.